This episode of Pub Talk Live was broadcast on June 13th, 2020, with guest co-host Jennifer Brody and special guest Jules Rivera. Hi, everyone. Hello and welcome to the June 13th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I'm your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, board member, and agent liaison at Pitch Wars, and I am also a library event planner. Just a reminder, you can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so that you don't miss a show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. If you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. Thank you all so much for joining me. And I have a little bit of an announcement. There are now Pub Talk Live Pubber t-shirts available. So I put them up last night. So if you look in the description right now where it says merch, you can find that link there, and there are a lot of different styles available. So I just wanted to have that available for y'all because you are so great. So it says as Pub Talk Live, like the logo that's at the top of the screen on the front, and then on the back it says Pubber. So yeah, I'm gonna bring on my guest co-host. Jennifer Brody is the award-winning author of The 13th Continuum, graphic novels Spectre Deep 6 and 200, and the Disney Chilled book series, writing as Vera Strange. She's a graduate of Harvard University and a film and television producer and writer. She began her career in Hollywood on many films, including The Lord of the Rings and The Golden Compass. She lives and writes in Malibu by the beach, where she's hard at work on her next book. So please welcome to the show, Jennifer Brody. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Sarah. I'm so happy to be here. Happy Saturday.
I'm so happy you're here, too. Let's see. We got some people joining us. Hey, Bess. Hey, Jessica. Thanks for stopping by. Hey, Heather. Tamara, good to see you. All right. So we do have the viewer poll, so I'm just going to drop that link in the comments right now. So if you haven't voted in it yet, you have about 17 minutes to do so. And the question is, do you read graphic novels and or comics? So yeah. Tamara says, hey, Jennifer.
Hey, how's it going? Do you read graphic novels?
Let's start.
Yeah.
Let's get you going.
And if you're watching the replay of this, obviously the poll isn't going to be available anymore, but you can feel free to leave a comment down below if you would like. All right, so we have lots of news items for you. Hey, Victoria, so glad you could join us. Oh, and I have a new layout. Do you see the layout?
Do you're you like so it? Fancy, Sarah. Look, you're on my sofa, yo.
Yeah, these are curtains. It's just the curtains in my sister's spare bedroom. So, yeah, so we're going to jump right into news. So everyone knows, at least I hope they do, about the Black Lives Matter protests that are taking place around the world right now. In this environment, a lot of publishers and agencies are promising to do their parts to diversify the industry. And some literary organizations are showing their true colors or being explicitly called out and exposed on social media. There are so many of these instances that if we talked about all of them, we would spend the entire show doing so. So I'm just going to talk about some of the most discussed events, and I'll leave links in the description down below for more if you'd like to check them out later tonight. Those include articles about Glasstown, PW's article on publisher actions, a publishing day of action, publishers raising money for causes, tattered covers disaster, bookstore showing support, the Poetry Foundation, Kid Lit Rally for Black Lives, and more. But we're going to talk about a couple of the instances later today. Oh, Heather is asking, what kind of wine do you have, Jennifer?
Hey, I actually have two kinds open because Jules is here, my artist for my graphic novels, who we'll chat with later, and she doesn't like white wine, so she's drinking a red Malbec. And I'm drinking, gosh, what is it? I think it's like a Pinot Gris from Oregon. Nice. But in the summer, I like the white. Yeah, it's happy hour, right? Are we happy?
Yeah, they're in California, so it's 6 o'clock there, which is
6 o'clock time. And it's Saturday. I figured, and I just finished. I'm in a book deadline hangover, so I'm like decompressing.
So Jennifer, you have the first piece of news for us.
Yes, as protests around the world continue, demand for books about racism has risen quite a bit. I'm sure everyone around has been seeing the list pop up all over their social media feeds. Most of the top-selling books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Libro.fm, and Audible were anti-racist titles. Five of the top 15 titles on last week's New York Times list for nonfiction addressed racism, including The New Jim Crow, which was published 10 years ago. The week before, there were zero anti-racist books on the list. And I saw this news and I was super excited, especially the bestseller list. And just to see a lot of books that I've actually read, I have a film project loosely kind of revolving around a book called Color of Law. And suddenly to see that pop up, it's a book about how governments and municipalities intentionally put in pro-segregation policies to make it harder for people of color to own homes in certain areas, essentially segregating places that were actually desegregating in the turn of the century. So yeah, and then that book's a bestseller. Wow, very cool.
Yeah, I was interested to see, especially The New Jim Crow, because like I said, that book was 10 years old.
Color of Law, new. Someone gave it to me at a residency in the Banff Center like many years ago. Nice. Yeah, it's the same. And yeah, yeah, Jim Crow. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, because I know The New Jim Crow, or at least the author, makes an appearance on 13th, which is the, you know, documentary on Netflix. So I wonder if maybe that had some sort of effect.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I'm such a like pro reading person. I think reading inspires empathy and inspires understanding. And I think it's such a complex issue in so many facets that the more you educate yourself, you know, and these authors have done tremendous work researching it. I have a really close friend who I adore, who's a professor at Princeton, and she's the world expert on blackface, and her debut history novel will be coming out. And she sold it during the Megyn Kelly situation. Mm. But again, it's one of those issues that resurfaces and resurfaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so important to call it out, to talk about it, to write about it, to have good discussions.
Yeah, I know. Got the audiobook of How to Be an Anti-Racist from Libro.fm like 2 weeks ago. Because I'd read most of the other books that are on these lists, but I hadn't gotten onto that one yet. And then just this week, Libro.fm sent me an email offering me a free copy to give to someone else. So that was pretty cool too.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think, you know, the more we talk about these issues, the more we talk about these books and elevate the authors, the better. You know, and I think, you know, we're going through a lot of difficult things, but I think the idea is change. And where does change start? And that is a place where change starts. It starts with reading. It starts with discussions. It starts with learning and not being ignorant and really understanding, especially for people like us with a lot of privilege. You know?
So if you want to see the list that we're talking about, the New York Times list anyway, you can find the description in the link in the description later tonight. If this is your first time watching the show and you don't know, all the news items that we talk about, I put the links in the description as soon as the show ends. So you can go and read more about anything that you want to know more about. So including this next item, which is something.
This one.
if you haven't yet heard about J.K. Rowling's transphobic tweets and follow-up blog posts, I don't want to spend too much time on them because they're pretty terrible.
They're terrible. I know. Yeah. They literally, I get physical reaction. They hurt me.
Yeah. But instead, I'll share with you Daniel Radcliffe's response reposted on the Trevor Project's blog. quote, transgender women are women, he said. He went on, it's clear that we need to do more to support transgender and non-binary people, not invalidate their identities and not cause further harm. So you can read his full statement in the link that I'll drop later tonight too.
When I read what Daniel wrote, it absolutely made me cry. I mean, I was like, he is Harry Potter, right? Yeah. Like, he is Harry. I know I have like a tiny Deathly Hallows tattoo. I'm a huge fan. And I think a lot of us who came to young adult literature, Harry Potter was a gateway drug, you know, to reading and to even wanting to write it. Sarah, but they had such a huge impact, and they have a huge impact on just teens and readers that show up at my events all the time. And so this hurts me, I think, a lot. It's not a new thing. She's done this a lot, but you know, I'm like, can we keep the books? But oof, call her out. But I think Daniel did it so beautiful, yeah. You know, and I think as the face of this, I'm like, let's just let him be Harry and we're right.
Yeah. I think like there's been a lot of conversation online because I know it's been such a huge part of so many people's lives for so long. And one of the things that I tweeted, like, if you like the story means a lot to you, obviously. So I wouldn't expect people to abandon that, but maybe don't give her any more of your money, you know?
I completely agree. And I think we can close that. I mean, yeah. You know, it's not been wonderful, especially there have been other issues with the retcon of a lot of characters.
Yeah.
This isn't, again, it's not a new thing that's just happened. I just feel that maybe it's getting the attention it needs right now. But yeah. I completely agree. And there's so many great books, and it's like, I have a big thing about also new series, right? You know, Harry Potter is a white fantasy world. Let it live in its little white fantasy land where it came from, right? I mean, it is. It was Lord of the Rings. Like, it's a product of time and place. But now we have amazing new books, new series that are bringing new ideas and diversifying a lot of elements. Like, just let it be. Stop retconning it. Let it live where it came from, you know, and move into what is now and support new series and new books. And yeah, you're right. Let's not give her more money.
She has enough. Hey, Jennifer. So glad you could join.
$1 million castle. Let her take her Twitter account. I don't know. Stop tweeting.
Hashtag okay, Karen.
Jules is on hashtag okay, Karen.
Yeah. So this is funny, but our special guest is actually with Jennifer right now, just off screen. So we'll bring her on.
Her wife. This is Jules. She's my artist on, well, we have 6 books so far. We're pretty much married.
We've done like 2 out of the 6 of them. So it's good.
All right.
Okay, so wow, this is one I didn't know about, but hey, Sarah, the National Library of Israel is digitizing more than 2,500 rare Islamic manuscripts and books and making them available for free online. Great, that's fantastic. Some of the books are over 1,000 years old and include works decorated with gold leaf and wow, I cannot pronounce this word. Jules, how do I say it?
Lapis lazuli.
Lapis lazuli. What is that? Is that a color?
It's a blue stone. It's kind of like a turquoise. Kind of like the edge of Spectre Deep Six book.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, that's so she says it looks kind of like the edge of our book.
Oh. It's kind of like that.
Ah, there you go. Yeah.
That's great. Well, free books, old books, cool.
Yeah. And if you go to the article that I'll post later today, you can see some of the pictures of the manuscripts, and they're beautiful. Like, they're just, like, gorgeous. Yeah, I saw this, and I was like, well, that's because I feels like so much of the news right now is like about coronavirus and Black Lives Matter. And so this was just like something that was kind of buried in between several other items. And I was like, oh, that's interesting.
It's interesting. And it kind of like, it does like hit a different part of my brain. And I'm like, yeah, wow. It used to be really hard to make books. And it used to go into the artistry of the printing and the hand design. Yeah, very cool. And it is nice to talk about something that is positive.
Yeah, and some of those books, I don't know how they last that long. You know, how do these books last 1,000 years? That's pretty great.
I know, it's like some Book of Eli stuff.
That's a book.
All right, so last week, the Publishing Paid Me hashtag created by Ella McKinney rocked literary Twitter's world. Authors, including best-selling authors like Roxane Gay, Holly Black, John Scalzi, and more, posted the amount of their advances in an effort to bring transparency and expose the disparity between white and black authors.
How did you feel about this, Sarah? I read this and I was like, wow. But also, I mean, I know I work in the industry.
Yeah. Right? Well,
how did you feel?
When it was happening, I was like, just completely like entranced by it. Like I just scrolled Twitter for like hours as, you know, it first started like building up steam. And part of it is like, I just want to see, like, cause you, people so rarely talk about money in this industry, you know?
I think that, and they rarely talk, I teach writing workshops and novel workshops with a writing pad here, but, and I do talk about the business of publishing and I'm very transparent to my students. I'm very happy to answer any questions. You'd be surprised how rare that is in MFA programs. And people don't like to talk about the realities of the difficulties, you know, Sarah, cause you're in the industry too. This dirty secret of publishing. And so yeah, to see it on Twitter, and not only on Twitter, but from, you know, I'm a huge fan of John Scalzi. He just wrote about me on his blog. I idolize him. And yes, he does have very big book deals now, but he didn't in the beginning. I mean, I don't know how you felt even just seeing that. And then you start to get to the disparity with people of color, right?
Yeah, Victoria commented, cannot believe how little Roxane Gay received. Yeah, Roxane Gay and I think N.K. Jemisin, those were two big.
The fifth season might be the best book I've read in the last decade. I'm like so obsessed with it. And I read it, I think, before it even won a Hugo. I'm a big sci-fi fantasy nerd. And I, you know, and I showed up at this program called the Launchpad Astronomy Workshop for Writers. And they were like, she had the idea when she was in this program. And I was just totally fangirling. By the way, if I ever met her, I would like die. Like that's my girl. I know Laura. And sorry, I'm not stalking her or anything. I just am a huge nerd fan of her writing. But yeah, the amount she received, and this is after she was already established.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't an out of nowhere debut author. This was someone with a proven track record. And those books won 3 Hugos back to back. She's the first author to win 3. She's the first Black woman to win a Hugo. Like, yeah, and you saw the amounts, and obviously we get royalties off the back end, but it was lower than I, you know, expected.
How much?
$25,000 a book for 3 books. I'll say it, Jules. That's what you said on Twitter.
Say the words. Say it.
I couldn't remember how much it was exactly, but it was definitely lower.
For her 3-book deal, and I think a lot of people see our deals, right? And we can talk about how the logistics work out, and they see, oh, so that would be like a $75,000 contract, right? But what they're not seeing, right, are the breakdowns of how you really get paid, which is, you know, only half the money usually in the beginning per book. It's for 3 huge multiple point of view fantasy books. These aren't like little 30,000 word, not to denigrate those. I write those as well, right? But to say like that's a lot of effort and work on her part. So if you really break it down per hour, you know.
It's like how, out of curiosity, no, I'm going to ask this. All right. So if... How big were these books?
They're on my shelf. You can go get them. They're long.
They're really, really huge books, right? Okay, so
they're not like Game of Thrones long, but they're big books.
Okay, but I'm just going to bring this up because we're going to have the transparency of the conversation, right? So the thing is, the way advances are broken down, for those of you who don't know, is that a lot of times you only get paid half the advance up front to do the book, and then you'll get paid half when the book is completed. So that means, and Kate, what was her last name?
Jemisin.
N.K. Jemisin did her books for $12,500 to make this giant ass fantasy book, $12,500 a book, and then 12 and a half on the back end. That is shameful. Who's her publisher? Who's her publisher? I want to know.
I actually don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
Is it Tor? No, it's not Tor. It's
shame.
One of the big ones. It's
shame
big
on you. Whoever you are, shame on you. You made this woman write 5 amazing fantasy grit novels for $12,500. That's not even minimum wage. That's not even a full year.
All right, I'm putting you off. Okay. But yeah, no, but isn't it? I mean, it wasn't just her. There were other writers too, where you see Victoria Schwab, who's a huge best-selling author. And I love Victoria's books. Like, it's not that much, you know? So it's important to talk about. It's important to talk about a living wage. For writers, I mean, what are your thoughts, Sarah? I know you're an author as well.
Yeah, well, the other part of it was a lot of the people that first started posting were the people who are getting like 20K plus advances, which are not as much as a lot of people expected. But what a lot of people don't realize is those are actually pretty high advances.
They are. And I will say, isn't there this thing where you feel insecure when you don't get like a huge advance?
Well, I saw so many people tweeting, like authors saying, oh, I participate, but my advance wasn't that much, or I would participate, but I didn't get an advance. But I think they should have, because I think that's an important part of the conversation. I posted mine. For 3 out of 4 books, I got no advance. Granted, they were digital first lines, so they didn't have a print run, but still I got $0 advance. And I made sure to post that because I think that should be part of the conversation too.
It is important to say that we do get royalties, but most books don't earn out their advances, and most books sell very little, even bestsellers. Now it has come way down how many books it even takes to land on the bestsellers list. My advances are definitely lower in the beginning than that. And with my Disney contract, I'm starting to get paid more money. But that also is a different scenario because that is more work for hire with their IP work, even though it's not like ghostwriting. Like, it's very transparent that I write them. I get a lot of creative freedom. I love the series. For my original work, and especially when we start to get into things like short story collections, graphic novels, we're going to talk less money.
Way less money.
Yeah, Jules is saying over there, like, even getting advances for a lot of that stuff is kind of rare sometimes, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of writers work for very little, and, you know, we're expected to write on spec a lot. We're expected to do a lot of work for free.
Yeah.
You know? It's a valuable conversation, and I think, it goes to a larger question of monetizing creative work is incredibly hard. It's not just writing and authors, right? It goes to other sorts of artistic endeavors. It's hard to monetize creative work, especially I think in a society that overvalues certain aspects and overpays certain individuals and undervalues artists and the importance of that and pays us less.
Yeah.
I think that's a larger cultural conversation, of course. And a lot of people look at the lottery winners, right? Like J.K. Rowling is a lottery winner. So is John Scalzi, right? And it's not to say they don't work hard and they didn't work hard, but they are that 0.00001% of our community. Right? Most writers have day jobs and have other work and cobble together incomes. Jules and I both teach. We both teach workshops. You know, we do book consulting. Mm-hmm. We do freelance. We do work prior. I don't do as much freelance anymore, but in the beginning of my career, I did a lot of
people are always surprised when I tell them a lot of writers, even writers you've heard of, they have day jobs. They can't support themselves on writing alone. The only time I really see people, especially starting out, who are able to go full-time writing are people who have partners who can pay all of the living expenses.
Or they're independently wealthy. And I think that's something that doesn't get discussed as much as it needs to get discussed. But also, I'll point out someone like Roxane Gay. I don't know what she gets paid exactly now, but my gut feeling, she gets most of her money from speaking fees. Right. And I know other writers like this. There's a friend of mine who wrote a best-selling memoir, and I think she got paid pretty well for it. But I bet she gets more money for speaking engagements, which is a whole other sector of the industry, especially when we start to get into memoir and nonfiction community. It's not as much usually in our fiction community. I think they make more money in those ways than they do off the books.
Yeah. And kidlit writers make a lot of money, too, from school visits and that kind of thing. I do want to move on, but I would like to mention also Deadline City, which is a podcast by Danielle Clayton and Zoraida Cordova. They did a whole episode on this topic. So definitely go listen to that if you want to learn more about it. I definitely recommend it.
They're great. The Bells was so fabulous.
Yeah. All right. So Jennifer, you have some of those bad actors that we
this is gonna be hard at the beginning. Yeah, I was saying to you, Sarah, before we started this, I was like, usually in a week or two we have a couple big things. I feel like this week, these last 2 weeks, 400 crazy stories have been breaking. So this is another one I followed. Oh wow. Literary agents at Red Sofa Literary resigned and clients left owner Dawn Frederick after she tweeted about calling the police on quote looters at a gas station. By the way, this was in Minneapolis. It was in Minneapolis, right? Makes it worse. And then doubled down in several tweets and a blog post. She later posted an apology. Did she? And deleted her Twitter account. Since then, she has sent several authors and agents cease and desist letters for tweeting about the incident. I didn't know that part. That's scary. Wow. What do you think about this, Sarah? I have thoughts, but what do you think?
I think so. This is what I was saying to my friends. I was like, okay, even if this is how you feel, how can you be the owner of a litter agency and not read the room and not realize that you shouldn't tweet that out publicly? Even if you feel it deep in your heart, you're a literary agent and you're supposed to have your pulse on the industry. How did you not realize that this would be?
I kind of want to hashtag JK Rowling here. Same idea. Also, you know, this is another parent hashtag. This is another hashtag
parent.
They
don't have to do better. They've never been required to do better until now.
Jules is right. They haven't.
They've never been retired. Been required to do better until now. Like, they've been just been racist with all impunity. So
yeah,
you know. And she's in Minneapolis, which we can see. There's a huge problem. And I think from following this and knowing individuals who not only worked for her but were represented by her, apparently there was a long history of bad action. This wasn't. Again, like I was saying about J.K. Rowling, this wasn't like a out of the blue, oh my God, we had no idea, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure you followed this, Sarah. I know one of my friends who I adore, who I met from a panel and have stayed close to, he left her. She did represent him a lot. I think a lot of her clients left her, right?
Yeah, a lot did.
You know?
But some still have like contracts on record with her, so they still have to deal with her to get their money, basically.
Yeah, Sarah, I think that's the hard thing that people don't understand. It's like I always say, like signing with an agent is a little bit like getting married, and then you get like divorced, but you still have to like pay the money and like deal with it. Because a lot of people don't know this, but they still service your contracts, whatever they sold mm-hmm. for you, and they still collect royalties off of that, or their percentage, sorry, off of what you earn. So yeah, it's like it's like literally like your ex-husband or your ex-wife.
That's a good analogy. And there was another literary agent that had a similar meltdown.
Oh yeah, you were telling me. God. How do we pronounce this? Corvisiero?
Yeah, Corvisiero.
Literary agency suffered a similar fate when its owner criticized protesters in a tweet. After several staff members resigned, she emailed all of the staff firing them. Wow. Let's back double Karen. Down. Karen's gonna Karen. But I let's give respect also to the people that sacrifice jobs, authors who sacrifice representation. It is a mm-hmm. tough industry. That is a big thing to give up, especially, you know, I'm assuming she has done good deals for certain individuals to leave someone who maybe you thought was a good actor, you know, respect. And I think it was one specific agent that worked with her who really kind of put her on blast and was very public. And that, you know, having worked in Hollywood most of my career, and I've worked for every horrible person that you've seen in the news on the film side, there is a fear of getting blackballed, of getting pushed out of the industry, not getting hired. Oh, you're difficult. We don't want to sign you. We don't want to hire you, you know? Yeah. And I think that that takes a huge amount of bravery to speak your heart and to speak your mind at possible risk. And I think we as have to have their backs as well to say, and to seek out people who have that, you know, and to hire. I try to be very careful about who I put on my team and who I hire mm-hmm. to work with, or even who I partner with, like Jules, my work wife, because
she says she's careful and then she brings my crazy self in.
Yeah, the voice says, yo, but yeah, no, it's, you know, I think we need to show them our support as well.
Yeah. And I think it's important to know when you're trying to decide what to say and how much to say when you're in that situation. I think it's important to know that the large majority of the industry, or at least the vocal members of the industry, are going to have your back. But I will say Corvisiero has had some like red flags before. And so this, again, wasn't like a huge surprise. Like I literally was not surprised at all that this happened. And I was really not surprised that she just fired all her staff in an email.
Isn't it interesting? And I mean, I would say it's the same with Red Sofa Literary, with J.K. Rowling, how instead of just saying, oh, we made a mistake, let us reflect on our words, let us look at, you know, where we went wrong, where our privilege blinded us, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, really doing some heartfelt.
They double down, yeah.
You double down, or like bring in a consultant, say we're gonna, you know, have an open dialogue. Yeah, instead they double down, say they were right, make it worse, right. Dig a bigger hole, fire people. Yeah, that's what's wild.
And you're being NFL.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that that's it's interesting to observe that behavior, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to just saying, even just not even like saying, like just say you're sorry. Like say, I am so sorry.
Oops, I done effed up.
I am fucked up. I am so sorry. You know, it's hard. It's crazy how hard it is for someone to just say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of it too is especially both of these people were people who are used to being in power and people used to being afraid of them.
That's what Jill's saying. And I would say with the toxic stuff in Hollywood that I have lived through and all of that, same concept there. They found they were untouchable. Even individuals who are now going to prison, they were used to being in charge, getting the benefit of the doubt, but also just having power and control over other people so they can do whatever they wanted. Ew, gross. Don't we hate that?
Yeah. It's getting the coronavirus in prison now.
That's right. Oh, gosh. All right. So we talked a couple months ago about the Internet Archives National Emergency Library, and I put that in quotes because it's not a library at all, which was lending out books it had never purchased or gotten permission to distribute with an unlimited, like, thousands of people could check out one copy. Last week, Hachette, HarperCollins, John Wiley & Sons, and Penguin Random House filed a lawsuit for copyright infringement. The Internet Archive has now ended their practice of lending out unlimited copies of books they hold zero license for, but the lawsuit is still going forward. And I think there was like a big misunderstanding on what exactly they were doing and what exactly libraries do. And so I, like anyone who has anything to say about this, especially if you're going to argue with me on Twitter about it, just like do some basic research and find out exactly what was going on. Because everyone was like, no, it's just stuff that's out of print or it's just stuff that's out of copyright. And it wasn't. It was new stuff. And also, they didn't even have physical copies of some of them because users could upload scans of books. So it could be anyone on the internet could upload a copy.
And I think piracy is a big issue we deal with. I mean, hello, China. Yeah. That said, it exists, but copyright is important, right? It's important because, again, this goes back to like how we get paid, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to try to move through the next two items real quick just so we can get Jules on.
Literary. Welcome to Pride Month. Lambda Literary has announced the winners for their annual awards in LGBTQ literature. Sometimes called the Lammies. See full list and winners in the link in the description later tonight.
Yeah. All right. So one more piece of advice, our news before we bring on Jules, and we're going to have some fun conversation, I can tell. A coalition of organizations is trying to make it a little bit easier for writers to get health insurance. The Book Industry Health Insurance Partnership has partnered with Lighthouse Insurance Group Solutions to provide health insurance options. The participating organizations include the Authors Guild, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, Novelists Inc., Graphic Artists Guilds, and Independent.
Writers.
Yeah, and Independent Book Publishers Association. There's also a couple organizations in there that are for booksellers as well.
Because I was actually excited because I had to buy my own health insurance. Welcome to being an author. And it's really, really expensive.
I know, like, there are several organizations that are like this. Like, there's the Freelancers Association that they use their collective bargaining power to get health insurance, which is how, you know, companies do it as well. And so this is 10 pretty large organizations that are combining to do this. And so in order to get the benefits from this, you would have to join one of those organizations. And some of them have like membership requirements. So make sure you go and check that out. And you can find out more about it.
Excited, actually. Yeah. I actually might buy health insurance through them. I know I'm in SFWA and Horror Writers. But we need this. Like, it could be really great. So I was excited.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a move in the right direction because we talked about authors having to work full time. Sometimes that's not because of salary. Sometimes it's because of health insurance.
Pre-existing
because
health insurance. Dude, I will tell you, I pay $500 a month for my health insurance on the independent market because, Jules is making noises. But, you know, also I was thinking of trying to get like a less good coverage. I hate having to think this year. Wow, good year not to downsize your health insurance when there's a- It's a basic human right. I think, you know, it's something we grapple with.
Because I know authors, when you're trying to make the decision of like, can I go full time as an author, you can't do it making the same if you have company supply health insurance, you can't do it making the same amount because so I would have to
rent, which is my health insurance.
I would have to make my salary plus like $10,000 a year, just for that health insurance alone.
That's what I'm saying. Mine, I said, was $500 a month. So, I mean, it's in the same range. Exactly. Yeah. You have to factor that in. And I think, like I just said, we are in a global pandemic. So even if you consider yourself, which, you know, number one reason for bankruptcy in this country is medical bills, right? Mm-hmm. But even like, oh, I'm a young, healthy person, which isn't necessarily the smartest thinking. We are in a pandemic, right? Right? Like, talk about hedging your risk. So I'm super excited. I got the email from, I'll give them credit, the Horror Writers Association, about this week. And I am very eagerly listening to see what is possible.
Yeah, cool. All right, so we're going to officially bring on our special guest.
Now, Joel.
Joel Zervaris, an Eisner and Ringo award-winning illustrator, animator, and writer, prompting Sci-Fi Wire to call her a multi-talented force in indie comics. She is the co-creator and artist behind the graphic novels Spectre Deep Six and 200. There you go. And the creator of a weekly web strip, Love Jules. Jules is... also creates storyboards and designs for TV and film and teaches storyboarding at the college level. She lives and works in LA when she's not surfing on the weekends. Did you surf today, Jules?
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah. my hair is still kind of wet and funky looking.
I do live right on the beach in Malibu. So it's the Mermaid Palace surf pad where graphic novels, what you turn your thing around and show.
Oh, you really want to see this whole shit? Because I'm wearing
these. Who's that? Things.
This is Virgil.
Oh, she's drawing Virgil.
I'm drawing the promo. Yeah, right. So I'm drawing the promo for 200 part two, our second book of 200. Mm.
So she's actually drawing one of our characters who is Virgil.
Yeah! I don't know if you can.
There's some man torso. Nice.
On display. Basically the next 200 book we talk about is going to be all about police brutality. It's going to be hilarious.
Wow, look at what we're doing. But she hand draws on a tablet all of this. So she's been sitting drawing while we've been chatting.
Oh, yeah. That's just cool.
Yeah. All right, Sarah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I did get a copy of Spectre Deep Six. I think your publisher sent it to me, and it's beautiful. It's gorgeous.
You.
Yeah.
There was not a single pixel in that book I didn't touch. thanks. I was really proud of how the book design came out, how everything just kind of came out looking real crispy and printed well. And I'm like, yes, good. Sometimes when you design things for print, it can get really dicey, especially you're never sure about how the colors are going to work out. So,
and this was a full color book. I want to give Turner credit for really letting us create this crazy thing, but also doing such a beautiful job creating the book.
They did a really nice job with the print job. Yeah. But as far as like the actual book layout and design goes, that was all me. Like I designed the entire book.
Cool.
Micromanager that way. Yeah.
All right. So the first question I want to ask you is mainly because I teach a lot of writing conferences and writing workshops and stuff like that. And I often get people asking me how an artist gets work as, for comics or graphic novels. And I never know what to tell them. So if you could answer that question, and I'll just tell everyone what you said.
I feel like the short answer is networking. Everybody needs to know that you are an artist who can do a thing, right? Jen found me because we were at a panel at Anaheim Comic Con a little while back, and Jen had actually seen some of my books. I was like, hey, here's some of the sci-fi work that I do. Here's some of my artwork, blah, blah, blah. You walk around, you show people what you do. Eventually, people get the idea that you are good at things and they trust you.
Yeah. I moderated a panel and she showed up and I was like, wow, this person is crazy and I love her. That's and her work was awesome and she was writing a webcomic called Love Jewels. You had Valkyrie Squadron.
Well, I had a sci-fi
comic that you were publishing.
I was working on self-pubbing a book called Valkyrie Squadron. I'll print it out of stasis eventually. As long as I get a big enough advance.
But she's right. It was networking. And I saw her work as well. And I was like, damn, this girl's talented. Like, I loved her vibe. I loved what she was doing. And I could see the talent. It's a hard thing. I mean, I will say, of all the horrible industries I've dealt with, comics is the most, like, mediocre white guy industry I've ever, like, come across. Sorry.
True facts. No, true facts. There's no lies here. No lies detected. No. Because if you want to tell, like, everyone's like, oh, my gosh, you know, comics can be, you know, really not exclusive. You know, it's nothing but white guys. And I'm like, it's true. You know, there's either the white guy with the glasses, the white guy with the plaid shirt, or the white guy with the glasses and the plaid shirt. And I'm like, how am I supposed to tell these dudes apart, right? And they all write the same stuff. They all draw the same titties. They don't even draw good butts. It's very upsetting.
No, and this is, and these are true facts. And I think even when Jules and I first teamed up and we were working on two separate ideas for proposals that we developed together, we went out to New York Comic Con partially to meet with publishers. And I will tell you, there were upsetting things. Even there was a publisher who told me, oh, we have a woman. I was like, you have a woman?
Wait.
Really? What?
Publisher said that.
I can't remember. It was like, we have one? Is that, you don't need more. You have your woman.
You just have the one woman.
Is she in the basement? Like, what's going on with your woman? No, but I'm saying, so 50s. I was like, okay, interesting facts. Yeah. And so especially we do science fiction primarily.
The Big Two is so rooted in the past. It's disgusting. Like, they can't even get their distribution right.
Oh, yeah.
They're still wrestling with that. They're like, Marvel's still kneecapped with Diamond. DC is going with this not distributor. It's really just a couple of dudes in his shop. And they're like, we're going to put all our distro here. And I'm like,
that did happen. That was interesting. We ended up, after Comic-Con, I ended up doing a lot more research and deciding what's cool, what's happening. Okay, here's what's cool about graphic novel. It's an exciting medium. It's diversifying. It's tackling really interesting storytelling that's different from just the superhero kind of cisgender white stuff.
Yeah, instead of, you know, balls and spandex.
Yeah, there's interesting stories, real stories being told. And a lot of the traditional publishers, the traditional book publishers are starting to see this. There is a big audience for comic and graphic novel, especially middle grade and YA, but an adult. And they're starting to dip their toes into this pond, which is graphic novel and comic, which has pre-existed. But after doing a lot of research, the big publishers are in the indie publishers, the book publishers, they actually have a lot more to offer. They have library market. They have more built-in distribution
better
models.
Taste. Jesus. If I'm going to be honest here. Okay. So to answer the long and short of your question is show up, look good, have something to show. That's how you get work as an artist. That's the answer. But, you know, you also have to pick the right employers because there's a lot of publishers out there who just publish the same Becky-ass stuff. And I'm like, oh, really? We're doing that in 2020?
Yeah, and Jules knows because Jules is actually much more steeped in this industry. So we actually sold to my publisher, Turner Publishing, who published my Continuum trilogy.
Yeah.
And I had told Jules from the beginning, I was like, we might be lucky to sell one of these. We had two proposals. And they stepped up and offered us a 6-book deal. So I want to call Turner Publishing out and say, you know, they've really invested in us and taken what I would qualify as a risk. The types of stories we tell are different than a lot of what's going on. But the interesting thing that happened is that the whole comic industry basically used one distributor to print their books.
And they
went under.
Yeah, well, they didn't go under. What happened was with the coronavirus that happened, Diamond Distribution, they were the only distributor for the big five, not just Marvel and DC, but Marvel, DC, Image, and Dark Horse. And I guess, boom. So
they can't put books out right now.
I think it's starting to trickle in, but Diamond was the single point of failure in a whole ass industry. So yeah, when they went down, the rest of the industry just went, including big guys like Marvel and DC, because they had these exclusive deals with Diamond to distribute floppy books, which in my opinion is kind of outdated. I don't know why we're still printing floppies.
That's a long way to say that, like, yeah, so we're publishing into this weird vacuum too. Like, we're very lucky. Like, most books got put on hold.
Our book release is just like, yeah, we're still on schedule. It's fine. Shut up. You're still on Deadline, Rivera. And I'm like,
with all the books. But yeah, I would say, and just from my perspective in terms of breaking in, because, you know, with graphic novels, it was just this thing. I love comics. I was like, I want to write comics. I want to write graphic novels. How do I do it? And it was just a process of
finding the right artist to work with. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah. And so then I found Jules.
Yeah. I can do things.
Yeah. So you all submitted together, like as a writer-illustrator kind of combo. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, thank you. That was a great question. All right, I have a question, and this is from a Patreon supporter, Lodestar. When storyboarding, Jules? Wow, are we doing this right now? When storyboarding, because I have a whole slate of film and TV projects, not even necessarily always related to these, but I bring Jules onto everything right now. When storyboarding, and she has a book on storyboarding, what is the typical process like, and who is involved in the making of it? Is it just the writer, the director, the producer? Is there an artist there to do the sketching? Storyboards, we're literally
I don't want any of those clowns in the room with me when I'm doing my thing. I talk to the director of photography, and everybody else can piss off, or the director themselves, because that many hands of that many people who have no idea about my job, no, get out. Just accept what I do. Just, I'm going to put it out here. This is what I did. You like it? Give me some notes. Otherwise, shut up. You don't know things. Let me do my job. So the question is like, who's involved? Me and the only person that matters in the, either the making of the movie.
It's usually the director.
And in terms of the actual sketching, a lot of times I'll just start with just paper sketching because a computer, you know, it demands a file size and you got to know exactly what you're doing. And if you're just blue sky sketching, sometimes it just helps paper just to go and figure things out. But I start on paper and I eventually work my way down to digital. A lot of times.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, my background is film and TV. So for a lot of this stuff, we're actually working like 200, which is the graphic novel we have publishing in the fall. I already attached a filmmaker, an amazing director named Jen McGowan, who directed a film called Rust Creek. And I've had my eye on Jen a long time. She has a lot of big television, like The Purge. I tend to only hire women or people of color as filmmakers, and I tend to partner with mostly women and people of color. This pre-exists everything going on now. It's a very big top-down effort on my part, especially because I'm swimming in sci-fi and genre, and there aren't as many women who do this. Most people may not know the amount of female directors in film is hovers around 6%.
Yeah.
6%, like what that falls.
And those are white ladies with privilege and cars and stuff.
Yeah. Cars. And Jen has been in this industry a long time, but she is phenomenally talented. Yeah. So we're currently putting a pitch deck together, and Jules is doing some art and storyboarding.
Yeah, I'm going to show you the cover. You're going to love it.
You know, in charge, this is the filmmaker. And then the next steps will be, we'll be setting this up at a big production company and attaching a big screenwriter. So, and it's a high concept, elevated sci-fi.
I don't know if we can see it. Yes. Okay.
Oh, it's wedged.
That's what she's actually drawing. So I have another project called Home Sweet Home, which is a fully packaged horror film that's based on a short story I wrote. And this is the one with the Color of Law inspiration. It's about, I wrote this 2 years ago. It's about a virus, a pandemic that only infects white people, black people. Oh my God.
You know what's funny? When she first told me this idea last year, I thought, wow, what a neat blue sky idea. There's no way this could ever happen.
No, the main character is literally a black epidemiologist sent in by the CDC to a small town in Virginia called Lynchburg to figure out what's making people sick.
You picked that name for a reason, didn't you?
Yeah, because I'm from by there. Damn. And yeah, it's called Lynchburg. It's true. True facts. And so it's fully packaged with a script and a filmmaker named Darren Grant, who is amazing. Zero Gravity is producing, a producer out of Blumhouse. And I had Jules work with Darren to create some storyboards for the pitch deck. And we're just about to go on submission to get money, hopefully go make this movie. But that one's like that's a too yeah. close to reality.
So yeah, it's the intersection of what's going on right now.
Start flipping out about the mask. Start flipping out about the hairdo. I'm like, why is Jen? How did you do this? Why is this happening in real life now?
No, even in 200, there's a whole thing about masks and medical masks and people wear masks. And I forgot about it.
She just wrote it in the script. I'm drawing it out, and I'm like, why am I drawing the actual thing that's happening
in
life right now?
And then Jules pointed out, she's like, I'm drawing all these masks on people. How did you know this is going to be? I read this short story like 4 years ago and workshopped it with Victor Laval, another amazing author of color that everybody should freaking read. I don't know. Like, that's the weird thing about sci-fi fantasy is you end up channeling too much reality. But I do.
Reality finds you, man. It's just, man.
All right, so I have the next question. Oh, no, Sarah, you have it? No, Sarah.
Yeah, I do. So this question is kind of for both of you.
Yeah.
What are some of the main differences between doing art and writing for comics and books versus TV and film?
That's probably more a me question.
I think that's a both of us question because I do both. Okay, so somebody, as a person who has written visual stories, I would say when you're writing a visual story, there's less dialogue, less words. You're focusing on panel descriptions. When you're writing a screenplay, again, you're focusing on just what you're seeing and probably more dialogue in a screenplay. Well, with comics, you have to shut up, because the reason why is because you can't have this long, sprawling dialogue unless you're Chris Claremont, in which case, really? Anyway, long, sprawling dialogue doesn't work in a comic because it physically takes up space. Those balloons and all that prattle is going to take up space. The real estate is expensive because your artist has to draw it all out. So I would say that's how a comic strip to me varies.
I mean, the piece I wrote for John Spalzy, for his blog, and that we talked about, was about how working with an artist on comics is very much like working with a director in films. And because of my background, I have worked on a lot of film projects, which includes the big stuff like Lord of the Rings, Golden Compass, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remakes. I've done a lot of horror. I've worked with Jonathan Liebsman, a lot of really cool directors. But films are expensive. You need someone to invest like a ton of money, millions of dollars for all this stuff. And so for me, graphic novels were this fun in between where, you know, you can draw the biggest sci-fi, but it's still just printing a page, you know, even if you have something simple. So
pause, hang on. No. Whenever writers always say, it's less budget. That they always say that when they always say that, here, give me this. No.
But
we're gonna have this conversation.
Budget than a movie. A movie, we're talking millions and millions of dollars. That's not what it costs to print a book.
I know, but you actually draw it out, and here, let's look at this. Hi, all of that. In fact, let's see more things that are hard to draw.
But I'm still right. It still costs way more. We're $100 million. Trust me, my Continuum trilogy we're packaging for big television right now.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, I think. I think what Jennifer's saying is it's not less work. It's just to actually bring it to life.
There's labor involved for sure. Yeah. Artists.
Of course.
So to say that there's no budget, I'm like.
It's not saying there's no budget. It's just that it is, you know, less than what it takes to make a very big budget film. And I've worked on these, like, especially to the bigger, like with 200 budget level, we're talking 40 to 65 million to make the movie, right? Mm-hmm. It costs that much to print a graphic novel. That's part of where it's fun for me, because I get this ability to put out something that's very visual, that has these elements of a movie or a television show, but I have more control over it. From my perspective, working with an artist like Jules is very much like working with a director on a film. They kind of take what I write and translate it into this very visual idea. And most of the time, if I've chosen the right partner, which I usually do, they elevate it, they bring different elements that I didn't even anticipate, and I love that process. So it's a fantastic question.
Yeah.
All right, I have the next question. As a creative who has her hand in so many different types of medium projects, how do you refill your creative well after so much creative input? How do you refresh yourself? Wow. I'm like, well, naps. I take naps.
I'm sitting here. I'm here at the beach house.
She's at the Mermaid Palace.
That's how.
She goes surfing.
Yeah, I come out and Jen lets me hang out, and I go surfing. Also, my energy stores are ridiculous. Like,
I'm kind of getting that. Yeah.
Yeah, right now, because I'm partially drunk and just got done surfing, so I'm chill. But usually, like, I can shout a lot harder. I'm just a very naturally high energy person, so I can take all of that energy and just pound it into graphic novels. Usually, I just take a nap, wake up the next day. If it was a really hard night, I may wake up at like maybe 10:30 and just go, oh, that was hard. And I'm lucky. I'm sorry. I don't know how, there's no other way to put it. I'm just a lucky person with too much energy.
I think it's a lot. And I think, you know, I talk to a lot of writers right now. I don't know how you feel, Sarah, with 2020 has been a year. And I think, you know,
it has been all the years.
Well, I mean,
this year has been 500 years long.
Oh, I know. And I, for me, it really started with Trump's election, was where a lot of things started to feel very hard for me in the world. Mm-hmm. And news cycles and the, and in 2020, wow, I thought this was the year we were going to move into something. I
thought it was going to be a happy year.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and also with us, like, we write topical science fiction, which is to say we are in dialogue with the present. We are in dialogue with the issues that are going on. So we can't, and people are like, just block it out. We can't do that. Like, we, and I think.
Oh, no. That is exactly not what you want to do. Sci-fi is all about talking about current events. So if you block out the current events, stick your head in the sand, A, you're a coward. I shouldn't buy your book anyway.
Agree.
And B, you're not going to be able to feel what the populace is feeling if you just stick your head in the sand and go, but let's just hold hands and be friendly. No, we're mad. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, and I think that's something to talk about, is that it's okay to be angry. It's okay to feel a lot of feels. I will say, having moved through, and Jules and I have both been on book deadlines, I was on one for my fourth book in my Disney Chill series for Disney, which I just sent off, thank God. But now I have to break book five. She's on deadline finishing 200 for us. I think having to work through what's been going on has been very interesting. And I think a lot of self-care involved. That involves beach naps, whatever you need, maybe a glass of wine at happy hour. I think self-care is really important.
My whole day is happy hour these days. I'm like, what is 5 o'clock somewhere? Good. Yeah.
I hear that from a lot of people in quarantine.
I live alone. What do I care? Lucky I wore pants.
I will say this, like having been like a weird person who stays at home and works at home mostly, I feel like a lot of the messaging before was like, you need to go out and be social. It's bad to be at home and have a glass of wine. And that totally flipped to like, this is a very socially responsible thing for you to do. And have a drink by yourself is very socially responsible. You know, I think that has been very validating. Yeah. Our lifestyles didn't really change that much, me and Jules, but like I feel like the world kind of moved into the weird stay at home and create weird art.
I hate people a lot more than I used to. No.
That might be true too. Yeah.
All right. So we're kind of running out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and skip to the last question, and I can go ahead and just ask both of you this question. And it's something that I ask every guest that I have on the show. And it's, what is the most important book you've ever read and why? And you can define important for you however you want to.
You have one, Jules?
What? I can't remember what happened last week. What? Okay. Let me think on that.
All right. Well, I would say one of the books that most influenced me, and it was Weight of Its Time, and it got rejected 100 million ways and places, is A Wrinkle in Time.
That's a good one.
Because it's this weird blend of like fantasy and science fiction, and it was really adult before there was really young adult in the traditional sense, and it was very mature and sophisticated. And I even liked the movie. I even liked the weird trippy Disney movie.
I love that movie. A Wrinkle in Time is easily one of my new favorite movies. Space opera is everything. Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, I read that way the hell back in high school when it first came out. But it was interesting to see such an interpretation of the world and go, wow, I guess we're never going to get back there. And then, you know, 20 years later, I'm like, damn, we're back there. And I'm like,
I love something that Margaret said, which was she didn't make anything up.
She didn't. Yeah. You have to make anything of it. I'm like,
that's what's cool about sci-fi is we really don't like
don't have to make up the atrocities. We just go, let's just do what that guy did over there, because it's happened all the time. I'm on Twitter. I'm always screaming at people. Whatever.
All right, those are great answers. So usually at this time I say goodbye to special guests, but Jules, you can stick around through the end. We just got a couple things to do.
Have I scared you off yet?
Huh?
We haven't scared you off yet?
No, of course not. I'm not easily intimidated.
No, we like you.
Awesome. If Ebony was here. So Ebony is one of our regular viewers, and she always comments on the...
Wait a minute. Twitter name looks familiar. You're one of my followers. You look familiar.
That's Tamara, but she's saying, if Ebony was here. Because Ebony always comments on the faces people make when I ask that last question, and Jules gave us an excellent example.
What was the face?
The face is the most important book I read, and I'm like, I have to remember things that happened. I can't remember what happened last week. I know things exploded and burst into flames last week. I'm happy for that. If I may say one thing about the current political climate. Hi, this has been the background noise of my entire life. I'm glad we're finally having these conversations. I'm in a weird state of comfort with all this because my life has always been about screaming at idiot colonizers and fighting for my rights. So now everyone's like, hey, Drew, we want
the Bronx in the 80s.
You feel at home, huh?
I mean, it's weird to say I feel at home, but yeah, like fist fighting colonizers. I mean, I'm Puerto Rican. Fist fighting colonizers are our entire existence for 400 years. So I'm like, good. I finally get back to doing what I'm feeling comfortable with.
It's so
good. I'm gonna burn all the things. It's gonna be great.
Just wait for the next we're gonna do.
It is brutality. Ow.
Yeah.
And Chris.
All right. So one of the last things I do on every show is have I feature an audiobook of the week. and it's just because I like audiobooks and there's really nothing deeper to it than that. And so the one I listened to last week, I think, was The Lost Coast by Amy Rose Capetta. It's narrated by Sophie Amos and Brittany Presley. And the little tagline from the publisher is, "The spellbinding tale of six queer witches forging their own paths, shrouded in the mist, magic, and secrets of the ancient California redwoods."
I want to read that. That sounds amazing.
Queer witches. Really good.
Sequoias. That's fun.
Yeah. And it was very atmospheric, and it didn't quite go in chronological order. Like, you kind of jumped around in time to tell the full story. And I just really enjoyed it, especially because I usually listen to audiobooks when I'm taking my walk, and I kind of live in the country. And so just like being in the country, like with this setting, was just really a good experience. So,
it's yeah. Awesome. I also love the cover design.
Beautiful. Yeah. And now we're going to discuss our viewer poll, which I know Jules has strong feelings about.
You got to read this graphic novel. I worked really hard to draw it. I know you guys don't read picture books, but I mean, try.
Yeah, so the question is, do you read graphic novels and or comics? I'm going to pull up the results and we're going to see what people said. And I will say, usually I post this poll on Friday night, but I had some other things I had to do, so I wasn't able to do it Friday night, so I didn't get posted until today. So we see fewer people participating than we usually do, but we have 24% of usually most of these are, you know, my followers who are voting, and so it is skewed, but 24% say they read them often. 41.4% say sometimes, 20.7 say rarely, and 13.8 say never.
Okay, so of that, looks like 34.5% of you, y'all gotta get caught up. This is amazing. I don't know why you would not want to be surrounded with this amazingness. I know people have a hard time balancing words and letters. How do you read IKEA instructions? Read this.
Fun. They're pretty pictures, and it's a more sophisticated, cool story than you might expect.
I mean, it's much cooler than balls and spandex, just saying.
Yeah.
Let me see what people are saying in the comments. Tamara said, I like that cover. Oh, that was Amy Rose Capetta's book.
Yeah, probably.
No, but that was a beautiful cover. We agree. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Tamara said, sorry, I will attempt to read one.
It's a great book. You're not going to regret it. You will be very happy. Look, Jen wrote it. It's so good. You like Jen's writing? Come on.
All right. And the final thing we're going to do before I say goodbye to my guests is talk about the book or reading quote of the week. And so these, if y'all will remember, I chose all of these in like October. And so sometimes they're a surprise to me when I see what they are. Oh, that's not the right one. Oh, sorry. This is the right one. Okay. But it is really funny how applicable this one is to this moment in time. Libraries will get you through times of no money better than money will get you through times of no libraries.
Snap! Oh,
wow. Wow, Sarah.
Bam.
Yeah. Several of the quotes that I've chosen have been like really applicable to either the times that they end up being in or the guests that I end up having. So I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit psychic.
Wow. I find most creatives channel.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously I work at a library, so you know I'm a fan of libraries. Well, Jennifer and Jules, thank you so much for joining us today. If you can just let people know, we have your website and your Twitter and your Instagram down below. So is there anything else you want to say before we say goodbye to you?
No, but I do want to say, so you have Jennifer Baker coming on. Oh my God, she's like my girl. I love Jen Baker. She rules. We've hung out together. We've done residency.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I'm really excited for her. I'll say that part now. So the next episode on July 27th will feature editor and writer Raquel Henry and editor and publisher Weekly's 2019 Rising Star, Jennifer Baker. I met Jennifer when I did Everywhere Book Fest. I produced that. And I asked her if she'd be interested in the show, and she said yes. And then I realized my friend Raquel Henry, who is an editor, is friends with her. And I was like, oh, that would be great to have both of you on the show together. So yeah, we're going to do that in 2 weeks.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jules and Jennifer. And I'm just going to do a couple of things to close out the show. So thank you.
Okay. Make sure you get Spectre. It's great, man.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. So if you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode, and tell your friends, because that is how people find out about shows like this. You can use the same link and people can still watch it forever, basically. So yeah, if they miss the show live, they can still come back and watch it. And also there's a link in the description to subscribe via reminders via email. And also there's a link in the description for my Patreon. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. Y'all really showed up last month and I'm just like so thankful for you. You can find the link in the description down below. You can find the social media for our guests as well in the description down below. Hopefully we'll see you in 2 weeks for the episode with Raquel and Jen. And thank you so much for watching, and I will see you next time. Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe.